Three questions, one for each. Brother Umar, when you are in shackles and wear your handcuffed, how did you perform your worships like prayer and siyam? Chris, a simple question. Could you compare for us three holocausts, one in Germany in World War II, one in Guantanamo, and one in Gaza? Muazzam, a question which may look hypothetical, but if we accept that Chris is next to you and has changed his mind, suppose you meet with ex-President Bush, George Bush, and he tells you, Muazzam, I don't want the fate of Ariel Sharon in coma for 4 years or more, not dying, not living, not breathing. I want to repent from what I've done to the Muslims in Guantanamo. What advice would you give him? Thank you all.
Three very excellent questions. We'll let Omar start off first.
I assume you mean in Guantanamo. You said Sheffield. I didn't understand.
Sorry,
Guantanamo. How do you pray? We prayed. We were able to perform. As you know, prayer, nobody can stop you from performing, praying to Allah Azza wa Jal. Allah Azza wa Jal has made it possible for us, even if we don't have water, for example. Sometimes they prevent us from having water to wash up with. We use other things, like, you know, tayammum and things other Muslims would not know. If they stop us, sometimes you're not allowed to stand. In Bagram, you're shackled. Sometimes there was somebody who in Kabul, I remember meeting a young Yemeni man who was in Kabul. He was shackled for many, many days in a dark cell, shackled to the wall like this. Even when he had to go to the toilet, he had to go to the toilet in his place. And he didn't know even what was in the room from the darkness for a long time. His name is Safar, a Yemeni man. But he still, I'm sure he did pray in the condition that he is. As you know, that God looks at our hearts more even than to our actions. Our actions are important, but the cleansiness of our heart is more so more important. I hope that answers your question.
Wait, you said this question was easy? That's well, I guess I would begin by trying to define what I thought a Holocaust was, and since this is a relatively, maybe not necessarily recent phenomenon, but recent classification or word for it, I think that a Holocaust would be any rounding up and slash or murder or slaughter of a people based on idealistic or ethnic reasons, and in that I don't see any difference between the Nazi regime of World War II and the American regime of Operation Iraqi Freedom or Operation Enduring Freedom, and I think that I think those two things both count as Holocausts, as far as Gaza goes, I don't know how. I don't think I would declare that as necessarily a Holocaust in of itself, but I see it as an offshoot or a part of the global war on terror, which is basically the OEFOIF, Operation Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom. So I would consider that part of the same war. Part of the global war on terror. Yes, that's definitely not an easy one. They always say it's easy when it's not.
Just if I can answer a little bit of what you said in relation to the question you gave to Omar. When I was first taken to U.S. custody in Pakistan, I was seated on a C-130 transport plane, which is an American military transport aircraft. And my hands were tied behind my back. My legs were shackled. I had a hood over my head and over the roar of the din of the engines, I could hear shouts and screams of other detainees and people swearing with American soldiers. I could make out, even through, despite the black hood, the flashes, the camera flashes that were taking place. And in all of this noise, I heard a voice in Arabic right next to me, although I couldn't see that this person was next to me. He said, "Akhi dakhala waqt as-salah." He said, "Salaamu alaykum," first. And he introduced himself to me. And then he said, "Dakhala waqt as-salah." Which was amazing that he could say this at this position. He said, "The prayer time has come." He said, "Hal nusalli? Shall we pray?" And I said, "Okay, anta al-imam, you're the imam." And that is how I performed my first prayer in US military custody, with my hands tied behind my back and a hood over my head. So if anybody ever asks me, was there any condition in which the Americans prevented me from praying, I say there was no condition in which they could have ever stopped me. But in relation to your question, brother, if Bush or anybody else, if anybody comes to ask for forgiveness, I believe, and we all know as Muslims, the first description of Allah is in the name of Allah, most compassionate, most merciful. وَسِيَتْ رَحْمَةُ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ. That His mercy overshadows and covers everything. And what is it? Had it not been for His infinite mercy, we wouldn't have all of the blessings and bounties that we have today. So in that feeling of the mercy that exists, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts upon us as Muslims, then President Bush and anybody else, if they repent, can be forgiven. And I have no doubt about that. But if he doesn't, and if he continues, and this is my position at the moment, that I don't think he ever will, then there are people waiting for him around the world with writs that they have prepared in the courts of law, ready to pounce on him for him to be arrested and charged with war crimes. If there's anything that we could say with Guantanamo Bay, is this. Perhaps they shouldn't close it, but they should empty it of all of its residents and leave it open for the real war criminals.
Excuse me, it's worthy to mention about the prayer that they used to use that prayer thing. It wasn't, maybe it might be a point to make, is that they used to use the prayer, they used to play around with the timetable, because we were locked up without any watches, we didn't know anything. Sometimes they played around with prayer, they used to ridicule, they used to make fun of it, and all sorts of stuff like that. And the thing about Holocaust, that's why we speak about Guantanamo. We speak about Guantanamo and how bad the Guantanamo place was, and speaking about, not because to make Chris look really embarrassed or anything like that, but it's to remind people how bad it is, so that never should that place be allowed to continue, nor anyone should justify its existence or try to do something like it again. That's why we always try to speak about how bad it is and how awful a place it is and so on, just to make people hate that kind of place and no justification for it.
I'll go to another. Okay, yeah, okay. So the lady over there in the black. Hi. A couple of questions. I'm from Michigan too. So to start with you, were there many others who felt the way you did while you were on duty there, do you think? I'm just wondering about the proportions. And if you were the minority, or even if you weren't, I'm wondering if you have any idea what might have made the difference between your attitude and your approach, the humanity of your approach to the prisoners, as opposed to other people who presumably came from backgrounds fairly similar to yours. And the other question I have for the both of you is, I think if I had been subjected to even a tiny portion of what you have been through, I would have incredible feelings of anger And if I wasn't feeling violent towards the West before I went in, I might very well be feeling violent after I came out. How have you managed to channel and control what I would think must be incredible feelings of anger?
It is so good to hear another Midwestern voice. I forgot your first part of your question again. Could you remind me?
I
can hear you.
I was wondering if you were in a minority of one or lots, and what you felt made the difference in the
gotcha.
Retaining your humanity.
No, definitely minority status. It reminds me of like the I know all about Christianity, though I'm not a Christian because they jam it down our throats. But it reminds me of when Christianity was first starting to come out, and people would draw the Jesus fish on walls and those things to signify. It's like a secret society. I mean, there were a couple other people of varying degrees who were kind of in the same camp, but not. I'm an absolute pacifist, which, you know, it looks totally kind of a conundrum with my involvement in the military, but I played a dangerous gamble with, you know, thinking that I would never be deployed, because I listened to my recruiter and thought that he wasn't a liar. I was definitely minority status, but there were a couple other people that were kind of along the same lines, but who were mostly just in that we should, you know, while we're here, we don't know what these people are here for. We don't know if they're guilty. It's more than likely that our government's full of shit. It's more than likely that they're here for the wrong reasons. So the best thing that we can possibly do is to you know, just go do our jobs, treat these people like people. That, you know, that totally understood that the people on the other side of these cages were people, and that we weren't in a place where we could do anything to fix the situation, to change it. You know, we're all specialists, we're all privates. We can't do anything that's going to radically make anything better. We can go there, we can go and we can walk the blocks, and we can be good people. You know, maybe give them a cigarette or two every once in a while, which happened occasionally, but with some other people, I never did it, but. Or, you know, just talk, you know, like, so there were other people there that were, you know, good people. It wasn't, you know, we weren't all horrible monsters. But I don't really know what to attribute I was raised by a mouthy little Portuguese dude who was kind of an absolute racist. Other than that, phenomenal dude, but I mean, he was like in the fashion of a lot of Portuguese people I've met, really super bigoted, and racism's just never really stuck with me. I've always, I've always thought that was wrong. My family are hunters. I'm a vegetarian. I've always thought hunting was wrong. I've just always been like this. I don't know. It predates the military for sure. And I don't know. Maybe I'm some kind of weird hillbilly mutant or something. I don't know. I'm not quite sure exactly what happened to me.
Being bitter, being angry, being full of rage clouds the senses. And we need our wits about us when we're doing this job. It's extremely important that we are able to be heard. There are plenty of people around the world who would like to discredit things that we're saying, who would like to continue to say that we are terrorists, that we are dangerous. Our designation, I wrote a book and I called it Enemy Combatant, not because I believed I was one, it's because that was our designation. That's what the President, President Bush, the United States military, the FBI, the CIA still think, me and Omar and the 500 plus people who've been released from Guantanamo, they still think we're enemy combatants. And the reason why they think that is precisely part of the reason why you asked your question, is that if you weren't a terrorist before you came in, after the way they treated us, and this is something that many of the soldiers used to say to me before I was released, I would be a terrorist by the time I was released. And the reality is this, that the United States has, that from that point onwards, gone on from hostility to hostility, either directly in invading countries or indirectly by supporting the Zionist state and other places with the bombs that fall in Gaza. They're also made in the United States of America, a great deal of them. Or with the bombing of Somalia and supporting of Ethiopian troops going into to Somalia. So that you can see the common denominator. But does this radicalize us? Does this make us want to fight against the United States of America? Well, in all honesty, the answer is yes. That is the answer. But our hands are tied. And just as in the time of the Soviet occupation, when the Mujahideen resistance fighters were fighting against the Soviets and they were lionized, I mean, you can check that with Rambo 3, they were lionized as the ultimate warriors who were fighting against the oppression and so forth. They're the same people now who are doing it. They're the same people who fought against the Soviets and the foreign occupiers. They're again now fighting against the foreign occupiers again. The difference is now that the occupiers today used to back them yesterday. And I support the right of people to defend themselves in these occupied lands. But this does not mean, for me, and I dare say for Omar also, that we use the same brush to paint the United States, or indeed the West with, that was used to paint us with. I have to say that every single Muslim, or even the ones who believe in the right of resistance, is a terrorist, who believes in the targeting of innocent civilians and so forth. The reality is that we don't, and neither do we reciprocate. So we don't turn around and say that everybody in the West is the same, that every non-Muslim is the same. This would be unjust to ourselves, and it would be unjust to other people. So there is a concept of justice that I think that we feel as Muslims, as ordinary people. And there's a verse in the Quran that says, "Oh, you who believe, stand up as witnesses for God and upholders of justice, and do not let your animosity of a people cause you to do them an injustice." The truth is enough. We don't have to add or exaggerate our position for the reality to become manifest.
I'd just like to state as a benchmark that Rambo has now become officially the most referenced film franchise of this tour.
Speaking about what the Muslim said about the Afghani people who were fighting against the Russians, and then now they were brought in Cuba and imprisoned and accused of being terrorists against the Americans. I remember a man called Muallim Gul, and he comes from Lagman, which is a city in Afghanistan. And one of his accusations, they have a couple of accusations against him. One of his accusations is that he was taught how to use the missiles against airplanes. And he said to them, "Look, the people who taught me how to use those missiles were American like generals and teachers, you know, teachers who taught me that. How is that going to be an accusation against me being a terrorist?" But back to answering a respected question, that we don't know. I don't really understand. I can't put my hands to say this is the reason or this is the reason. But we believe in that our belief probably helped us, because we live in the hereafter and we believe in destination, that anything that happens to us did happen to us according to wisdom. There's a wisdom behind it and we benefited. Though we have been treated badly and so on, there must be some benefit into it. We learned patience in prison. If I speak how much I learned in prison, maybe people think, after all, Guantanamo is a good place. But we learned a lot in Guantanamo, really. And I said this to Chris when we first met, and he couldn't believe it. But we did learn a lot in Guantanamo about ourselves, about mixing with people, about prisoners, about people's hatreds and prejudices, and how we should not be the same if we were in a position of power. All this, I think, you learn from other people's mistakes. And the belief that the one who turns days and night and controls the day and night is not America, but it is Allah. So everything is in according to a wisdom and written destination. So maybe all that gives us acceptance or something.
Okay, I'm going to take a question from that side to save Pat's legs, and then come to this gentleman here, and then there was a lady in the middle there. Okay?
Assalamu alaikum, Muslim Amar. I've seen you speak many times before, Muslim, and I commend you the way you've continued passionately speaking the truth. With regards to the American administration, I know Obama's in. I have no optimism that things will change. It's a change of face, but I strongly believe same capitalist, warmongering policies will be there, and that's all. The fact that you mentioned that if Bush apologised, you'd accept it, it has really taken me back. And I've got two questions for you, two short questions. We all make mistakes, and as civilised individuals, an apology is the least we can do. The first question is, how did you feel when verbally and in writing you received an apology from the head of the MI5, MI6, and Tony Blair? How did you feel? And second of all, with regards to detention of individuals, what's your opinion with regards to the 42-day detention within the legislation in the UK?
I think just to qualify my thing about Bush, my meaning was that nobody is beyond forgiveness. Everybody can be forgiven, and as Muslims, we believe that everybody can be forgiven. Nonetheless, I think he would still have to pay for something that he had done. As far as how did I feel when those apologies came that you're talking about, I never got any apologies. I've never had any apologies from anybody at all, other than from individuals like Chris, like some of the interrogators, some of the other guards I've been in contact with, the individuals. That's the only people we've ever received apologies from. If we'd had an apology, we wouldn't still be designated enemy combatants. But your question about the 42 days, this is extremely important for people. What we've seen and what is the common denominator around the world at present about detention without charge or trial, which Obama has not addressed and does not intend to address, is that people are being held in the United States of America, in Guantanamo, in secret detention sites, in Bagram, and in the United Kingdom, without charge and without trial, and in the rest of Europe too. There are many cases of this, and that is because the so-called British concept of habeas corpus, that a man should not be detained without charge or trial, something that existed or purportedly existed in this country since 1215 and the signing of the Magna Carta, has now been conveniently revoked, mostly for Muslims around the world. And 42 days pre-trial detention is something that has no precedent in this country. And I know at present it's 28 days. The government wanted 42, but prior to that they wanted 56, and Blair wanted 90 days. But here's the thing that people should recognize. I've been over to Northern Ireland many, many times meeting with former IRA prisoners, and some of those people have the most vast knowledge of what's taking place today through their own experience and through internment and what took place in Northern Ireland at that time. But at the height of the campaign of the IRA, which included the bombing, the mortar bombing of 10 Downing Street, it included the killing of Lord Mountbatten, the Queen's cousin and last Viceroy of India. It included the bombing of Harrods and Canary Wharf and Warrington and Birmingham and Guildford and a whole host of things in Northern Ireland. Detention without charge or trial at that time did not exceed 3 days. It did not exceed 3 days. And this is the situation where we're at. And the first people to point this out to me were former Republican prisoners. So it's as if we've had a collective amnesia when it comes to terrorism and how we deal with it here and the way in which anti-terrorism legislation has been forced through. The reality of this, in my estimation, is this: it stinks of a blatant kind of racism which today is called Islamophobia.
Hi. This is a question for Omar and Mazen. What was the worst psychological practice or torture used on you in Gitmo? And have you ever reached breaking point? I know it sounds like a silly question, but have you ever been broken down in the 5 or 6 years you spent there?
The worst that anyone can see or witness or experience, particularly for me, I spend a lot of my time before Guantanamo working on aid with aid organizations, going to Bosnia and other places, wanting to help people. And if you're of that mind, and I think most people are to a degree, that you want to help somebody, imagine seeing somebody tied with his hands above his head to the top of shackled to the top of a door. With a hood placed over it, he's punched and kicked repeatedly. If you attempt to move to try to help him, you can't because he's in a different cell. But if you do, you can get pepper sprayed or punched or kicked or have the same thing done to you. That feeling of impotence is probably one of the worst things any human being can endure. Because it's one thing dealing with your own persecution. You can deal with it. It's you physically. But to watch it happen to another man or another woman is unbearable. And the scars of that, I think, will never be removed. That is something that I don't know how to get over that. And if there could be anything on a personal level worse than that, it was for me on a psychological level. I mean, I wasn't beaten at the time when they were doing it. I was tied up with my hands behind my back and my legs. Was the sound of a woman screaming next door to me that I was led to believe was a member of my family being tortured and abused right next to me. There is no point in my life that I've ever felt the rage. You know, I'm normally quite a calm person, but I've never felt the rage, the sheer rage that I felt there, and despondency simultaneously as I did at that point.
I think the worst moments I remember in Guantanamo is when four of our detainees, so colleagues in prison there, died or were killed. And those were the worst memories I remember because one of them, I knew all of them, and they were, and I remember speaking to one of them just before, days before he died, and I remember what he had to say and why. And those were, I think, one of the worst moments there. But whether I came to break down, I don't know. I don't think so. Really, I don't think. I don't want to be sounding bragging, but I don't think so.
A question, just a quick question for Chris. It follows on really from the other woman from Michigan who asked you about the views of other guards there. I was wondering if there are any other ex-guards that are speaking out like you are in America now, you know, since they've left the army. And second question, if there are any repercussions, if you've had repercussions from speaking out in America, because there must be a lot of people who are angry at what you're doing.
There weren't until recently, but another guy's from Phoenix, Arizona has been contacting cage prisoners and talking with Mozam and I over the internet since we've started this tour. There's a girl in Chicago. I won't disclose any of their names, but I expect you can see them soon. So they're both extremely excited and willing to speak out. But I mean it's but also the repercussions are pretty large. It takes kind of a weird sociopath to get up on stage and to just not worry about all the things I'm just kind of not worrying about right now. So really the only repercussions I've gotten so far is kind of stress. I mean, just running through my own paranoid anxieties, but because technically this is treason. I haven't heard anything from the government or anything. Actually, everything's been really positive. The only thing I've heard are people who are supportive, and a couple people on blogs that say I'm lots of things. So, but I'm not really super worried about them. So, no real negative repercussions so far. Just my own head.
Can I just add to that? I was contacted by several former Guantanamo guards since my release, and many of them have spoken to me, and some of them called me on the phone and so forth. And they were decent, ordinary people I remember who were all okay and fine. But I never met Chris when I was there, And shut up, please. These Americans just have no respect. But the reason why I called Chris over was that he was willing to speak about his experiences in the public arena, not just in the private one. And that's why it requires a deal of courage to do what he's doing. And considering his age and considering some of the other people who were there, and some of them are a lot older, who've not done this, Chris and what he's doing is helping to give them the courage. And that's it's a very important thing. We have, during the tour, been contacted by at least one, and prior to the knowledge of the tour coming out, another former Guantanamo detainee who want to talk about their experiences. And of course, because they served in different places, in different times, in different units, met different people, their experience and their stories will be different and unique. So I think, watch this space on cage prisoners. Please visit the site regularly. Make sure that it's something that's on your reading list. One more thing. There is another former Bagram interrogator who's contacted me. And his story really is very, very potent indeed. He is featured in this film, Taxi to the Dark Side, alongside with me and many others. And he was called the King of Torture. That was his nickname by his colleagues, not by the detainees. And he was brought up for charges of abuse of detainees, not just in Bagram, but later also to where he was redeployed in Abu Ghraib. He was brought up for charges of female abuse, of female detainees. He was eventually charged with some crimes in the US military and exonerated. And then I heard him speak, and that he had joined the same organization as Chris, Iraq Veterans Against the War. And he had started to speak out against what he was doing himself and what he had witnessed. And the hardest phone call I ever had to make was to this man. Not because I wanted to, not because I wanted to make friends and so forth, but because one of the people who were being charged and pushed through one of the systems in Guantanamo had told me that this man had threatened to physically do some terrible things to him when I was in Bagram. So I asked his lawyers, would he be happy with me, if once they contacted him, would he be happy with me contacting this soldier to see if he could do anything to help him? And I phoned him and I said, this is a very difficult call for me to make because I remember the last time I saw you. And before I even asked him, he said, I'm already there, Moser. I need to get my life back into order. All the things that I did wrong, I have to try and fix it. And I have become a witness in the court for the defense of these people that I was involved in abusing. So some of us have to swallow some bitter pills, but there are people that are coming out slowly, slowly, but surely, and the effects of what they did is haunting them, some of them, the ones who did the abuses. Eventually, I think many, many more people will start to come out.
As Madam said, but there are people probably you might have known yourselves, because some of them came even here, like Captain John Yee. James Yee, he was a chaplain and he was a captain and he wrote a book. There was about the other person, what's his name, Sergeant, Eric Saar, wrote a book also about his experience. He was in the intelligence there and he was saying about himself how he was he came down to defend the country and do a service to Bush. And then he was disillusioned and how he was shocked and so on. His experiences are in a book. There is a couple of high-ranking people like now speaking in cage prisoners, and on the BBC you might see them, like Ibrahim Colonel. There's a colonel, lieutenant colonel, and he was responsible for persecution. He was the one who was prosecuting people, and he said how they were used to hide evidence and how they were locked up in cupboards and things like that. There's the other colonel. His name is, I think, Daryl Vanderveld or something. A very, 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 very good documentary in the BBC about this person. He's speaking himself how sorrow he is and how he can't live his life because of what he did. And he is one of those colonels who were head of prosecution. He had cases, files of people he used to prosecute, and he used to say that the illegal things that they were committing and so on. So I think just people you might have, I thought maybe remind you about these people, some of them you might like to read or hear about.
Okay, it's nearly 9:30, so we're just going to, I'm really sorry for other people who've had their hands up. There's two ladies really desperate there, but I'm going to pick this lady here, and that's going to be the last question. And then we'll probably about have 30 minutes of answers. They seem to have been very long answers, but it's been amazing. And then we're going to hand back to Maya Sam to talk about cage prisoners and remind you all to fill in your pledges and give us lots of donations on your way out. So just this last question, and I'm really sorry, you other people over there.
Questions to Mazen. You mentioned the voices of female at Guantanamo, and you've also addressed this in your book. I'd like to know, were there any female detainees at Guantanamo?
To my knowledge, there were no Guantanamo the detainees that were females in Guantanamo. I do believe, and I'm convinced that there were in Bagram and in other detention facilities. If you go to the cage prisoners website, you can look at, you can do some searches for prisoner 650 and find out about what the whole issue regarding this detainee was. I believe she was the one that was being made to scream when I was in a cell next to her. Other people who were held in Bagram saw her, witnessed her abuse. They described her. That's where we got the name or the number 650. The U.S. administration continually denied the existence of this prisoner until finally when Yvonne Ridley and other people continued to press them, saying that they would expose this case with all the evidence that we have, they finally admitted that 650 existed, but she was relocated to another site. But we also believe that there are other prisoners, and that again, it's not just about the individual prisoner. It's not about the place. It's about the policy. We asked what was their detention policy towards women. And they said simply, we don't have any. And we know that in Iraq, there have been many female detainees. We know this through documentation. We know this through people like the person I mentioned, who was brought up for charges of abusing female detainees. So we know that there's a policy towards female detainees because they have been incarcerated. And why wouldn't they? Considering they think everybody is a potential terrorist, if needs be. So that is it's a very touchy subject. It's a very sensitive subject, particularly in the Muslim world, but in any world, the detention of females and abuse of females in this way has, at least in Bagram, taken place.
Okay, thank you. So that's the end of the questions. So if we can hand back to Mazen to tell us a little bit about cage prisoners and the pledge and donations.
Okay, I'd like to first of all thank you all for sitting and listening patiently. I know it's not the easiest of things to listen to all of this in all of this time and the length of times that we take sometimes to answer our questions. So I thank you all. Cage prisoners is an organization that I joined on my return from Guantanamo Bay, and that is because it campaigned for the people held in Guantanamo. Since that time, it has extended its remit to people around the world, particularly in the secret detention sites in the United States of America and in the United Kingdom, where people are held either on control orders or held in the prisons of Belmarsh and Longlaughton and Woodhill and many others. So we've produced all sorts of documentation and literature, please, that I hope that you can take from the table at the back there. There are books and DVDs and so forth that you can hopefully benefit from. But the thing that we need more than anything else is your physical and financial support. We need your physical support in terms of volunteers who can help make these sorts of events happen, and financially so that we can pay for the tours and projects and reports that we produce and continue to produce directly from the horse's mouth. This is a prisoner-led organization. It is exclusive in that. It's not like other organizations that simply make it an academic thing. So I really ask you to fill out these and complete these cage prisoners forms for standing orders or pledges. It can be £5 a month, £10, or £2, or whatever you can manage. But we think that the consistent is better than the one-off. So if you can please, if I can please ask you to do that, it would be a great support to this type of thing that we're doing around the country. If you want to follow the tour and what's happening with myself and Chris, including discussions that we have in our car that are being recorded and so forth, without us realizing sometimes, we have an embedded reporter with us who is reporting on what we do, hopefully not to the CIA, but I don't know, regularly on her blog site, and it's called GuantanamoVoices.org. You can see a link of it on the Cage Prisoners website, or you can go directly to it, GuantanamoVoices.org. I don't think there's anything left for me to say. Other than thank you very much, jazakumullah khair, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.